reaching from way down here.
Yeah.
From way down here.
Welcome to Thread, a podcast designed to explore God's story and lead you into a full life in Christ.
Thank you for joining us in this conversation, co-hosted by myself, Hannah D'Souza, and Dr. David Pachter.
Though I'm way down here, I get a better view of this boundless world that I'm going to.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Thread. We are at episode 27 today, and
new
our title
series.
Is... I know. Oh, yeah. New series.
New series.
Mention that. We are in a new series.
Yes.
Which is called God's Land Established. And the title of today is Promised Land. I wanted it to be called Preparing for the Promised Land because the bulk of it is getting up to the edge of the Jordan before crossing over. Do we cross over in this episode?
We don't quite cross over, but it's all about the Promised Land. The Promised Land is in sight. We just don't quite cross over yet.
So it's in sight. So I hope the title isn't misleading, but it is preparing for the Promised Land.
For Promised Land.
For Promised Land.
Okay. So we are starting a new series. Israel has been in the desert now for 40 years. And this last series we did, which I think was 7 episodes, really explored all that Yahweh did to form his nation, Israel, in the wilderness. And now we're turning to this place in the story where we're going to have a little chat before crossing the Jordan into the land. It's a little chat. So before we cross the Jordan, you know, when we were preparing for this, I was remembering that song we used to sing a lot in our churches called Jordan River. You remember that song?
Oh, yes. It's a classic.
Class Jordan River, I'm bound to cross. Yeah, that song. So one of my daughters was when she was young and we'd sing this song. You know how sometimes kids think the words are different than they actually are?
Yeah. So, what did they think?
So, well, the song says, my sister, she'll be a-waiting there, but she can't help me across.
Yeah.
And my daughter used to sing, my sister, she'll be awake in there, but she can't help me across. Exactly. I don't know. Just awake in there. So, anyway, this little chat is the book of Deuteronomy. So basically, after this 40 years in the wilderness, we enter now. We're right at the edge of the Promised Land. We're right in front of the Jordan River. And Deuteronomy actually means second law or the second giving of the law. And right away in Deuteronomy 1, we see the location and the context of the conversation. So it says that the words Moses spoke to all Israel beyond the Jordan, in the wilderness, in the plain, in the 40th year. And so we have everything we need, right? We understand, okay, 40 years in, we're just about to come into Promised Land, and this is the little chat. So we're going to just kind of work through what's going on in this book, and we're going to focus on two major things today. But this is a really important moment, and we're going to frame it with this passage in Deuteronomy 3, and if you could read 27 and 28.
Look well, for you shall not cross over this Jordan, but charge Joshua and encourage and strengthen him, because it is he who shall cross over at the head of this people and who shall secure their possession of the land that you will see.
All right, so we are about to have this important leadership transition. Now, Moses and Moses and Israel together have been the key figures for this story for 80 years now. Mm. And we've spent 9 podcasts talking about Moses and Moses and Israel and all that's happened here. But this is the end of the road for Moses. Mm. He is called to hand over the reins to Joshua. So one of the things that I want us to talk about today is this leadership transition. Why Joshua? And we do learn a lot about Joshua and his relationship with Moses in small snippets of the story up until now. There's a number of key aspects that the scriptures bring out about his character, about the mentoring relationship that he had with Moses.
Yeah, I do love this mentoring relationship that we get to see exemplified in that relationship with Moses and Joshua. I think it's just inspiring to see Moses knowing that he himself is not going to enter the promised land, just gets a glimpse of it, that he's still preparing the next generation to be able to enter, even though he won't be able to. And I think that's such a gift that he gave to the nation in that preparation of Joshua to kind of spearhead that. And there was no kind of jealousy there that we see, which I think shows the humility of Moses.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think this, the prevalence or the prominence of spiritual leadership is important in this conversation. You know, we in the modern church, or the more contemporary church, I should say, there's often a resistance, a reluctance to spiritual leadership and to community and to the roles that leadership plays in the community. And I think this episode's important. I also think that we see this generational passing here, which is really important. But one of the things that's critical here is this kind of confluence of these key factors, meaning Joshua was gifted as a natural leader and he's mentored into the role. And we see this both and, right? We have to have leadership gifts, but we also need people in our life to help us to grow and develop those gifts that we're given. So there's this great passage in Exodus 17. It's really the first time we see Joshua on the scene. If you could read, Hannah, verses 9 to 13, it's actually back early on in the wilderness period when they come across this people,
Amalekites.
The Amalekites. Yes, okay. The Amalekites or Amalek. Nice. Yes. So can you read that for us?
I will. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some men for us and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. Moses' hands grew heavy. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on either side. So his hands were steady until the sun set. And Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the sword.
Yeah, I've heard this passage talked a lot about with prayer, right? We hear this analogy of Moses is praying and his hands have to be up for the battle to be won. And when he can't hold up his hands anymore, he gets help. And that's all true. That's a great way of looking at the story. But there's another thing that's happening here. While he's praying, Joshua's fighting. Joshua's on the front lines. Joshua's leading the military. So we see Joshua already in this leadership position, which is kind of the point. But then we start seeing a development of another aspect of Joshua becoming the man that he's needed to become. And this passage that happens a little later, you know, we talked a lot about Moses going up the mountain. In Exodus 24, verses 13 and 14, it says, "So Moses set out with his assistant, Joshua. And Moses went up onto the mountain of God. To the elders, he said, 'Wait here for us until we come back to you. Look, Aaron and Hur are here with you. They can settle your disputes.'" So we have this image of Moses and Joshua leaving together to go up the mountain.
Yeah, I was struck recently by this verse and something I hadn't noticed before, the fact that yes, this critical moment in Moses' leadership in which he's about to meet with God on the mountain and receive the Ten Commandments, and he brings Joshua along with him. But even the fact that in this verse, we see that the elders are actually told to wait back while Moses and Joshua travel up the mountain together, which was not something I'd noticed before. But when he says, "Wait here for us until we come back to you." And so they get this journey together. I don't know how far up Joshua went and whether he waited for 40 days alone while Moses was at the summit. But I think either way, he got to experience kind of the cloud covering the mountain. I think it says the glory of the Lord covered and settled on the mountain. I just imagine it must have done wonders for Joshua's faith to be able to share in that mountaintop moment of Moses' ministry. And definitely, I imagine, would have formed his own vision and leadership as this new leader that's coming after to bring Israel into the promised land. But I just love that Moses invited him into that. And I think it is a good model of partnership and leadership between generations. But you also pointed out, yeah, Joshua is called an assistant in this verse.
Right.
So we have this, guys, honoring and being invited up into these spaces on the mountain. But it's also clear that at this point, he's also assisting and being prepared for leadership, and he's learning. And I think, I know we discussed this in when planning for this episode, that that's also an important lesson, that great leaders learn by first being great assistants, mentees, and kind of putting themselves in those positions to be mentored.
Yeah, such an important spiritual posture. I think it's a critical lesson for all of us, but I think especially for younger generations. It's easy to want to be at the table, right? We want to sit at the table. We want to have a voice, but we don't want to be the assistant for a long time. Being the assistant is where you learn. It's where you gain wisdom. It's where you really grow in your own leadership development. And it takes a long time. And, you know, I'm in my 50s now. 50s? Yeah, 50s. I'm in my 50s. I have played the role of assistant for a good part of my life. And I find great joy in that. There's actually a lot of joy in being that assistant, being the person to help, being that right hand. So I think it's important that we have both, right? And you addressed something when you just said Moses invited him in. So the older generation, it's important that we're always thoughtful about inviting the younger generation in. And for the younger generation, it's important to not just participate and get involved, but be willing to be the assistant to learn. So one of the things that I think about with this in church culture, and particularly in evangelicalism and in restorationism, which is kind of our tradition, is when someone comes into the faith, we are quick to assign an older Christian to help work with them, to mentor them. And I think that's really, really important. It's really helpful. And it's a service, a right service of looking after shepherding younger Christians when they first become part of the church, whether those are teenagers or campus students or even adults that first become Christians. But there's something that doesn't happen because that happens. And it's this. We don't think as older Christians a lot about pursuing and assisting others. We don't think about choosing mentors and going after people that we want to have influences in our life. And I think it's easy to kind of get used to, well, someone is going to assign that to me or then I don't have it. And I think it's important as we get older to pursue that ourselves. So anyway, that's one thing that I think is important to learn from this lesson. So there's two other important references to Joshua in Exodus and Numbers that speak to his character. One's in Exodus 33:11, and the other's in Numbers 14:6-7. Hannah, would you mind reading those two for us?
Yeah. So Exodus 33:11 says, "Thus Yahweh used to speak to Moses face to face, as one speaks to a friend. Then he would return to the camp, but his young assistant, Joshua son of Nun, would not leave the tent." And Numbers 14, verse 6-7. "And Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh," I definitely got that wrong, so apologies if anyone has that name. "And Caleb, who are among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes and said to all the congregation of the Israelites, 'The land that we went through as spies is an exceedingly good land.'"
So this first passage talks about Joshua being this assistant, being with Moses when he goes to the tent of meeting, and how Joshua doesn't leave the tent. I love that image of him just wanting to be in the presence of God. But then the second one comes from that famous story in Numbers 14, where the 12 spies went and they all searched out the land, and there was a lot of faithlessness. They were very intimidated by the vision of the promised land. And Joshua and Caleb had this faithfulness, this spirit about them. It says, oh no, we can do this. God's on our side. And so we see a lot of things here about Joshua that become important for why Joshua. He was a natural leader. he was really willing to play that role of aide or assistant to be a mentee, to allow Moses to mentor him. And he also was a spiritual man. He was faithful.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's also, that's always been something that stood out to me about Caleb and Joshua. In speaking about, I guess, leadership, we do value charisma often and skill and natural talent. I do think what's significant is that they were spirit-filled, and that's what's kind of elevated in the passage. I think about Numbers 14, where Caleb is described as having a different spirit to the others.
Yeah.
Because he served wholeheartedly, is what the verse said. And then Joshua, yeah. Numbers 27, when he's first appointed, it's take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the spirit, and lay your hand upon him. And then again, at the end of Deuteronomy, at the very end of the Torah, chapter 34, he's described again as being full of the spirit of wisdom. And so, yeah, I love that those are the qualities, or that quality is what's elevated in them and what makes them great leaders, what makes Joshua the right person for this job.
That's a hard lesson to learn in a contemporary church life, that the best long-term leaders are those who walk in the spirit. Mm. And it really is easy to lean on charisma or talent.
So much. Yeah.
Right. So, and we see the price that gets paid when the spiritual side is not developed. So we've explored the why Joshua piece. The other thing I want to get into here today is what's really happening in the rest of Deuteronomy in this little chat before they cross Jordan is really getting prepared to cross over. And what is it that Yahweh believes is important for them to be prepared? So in Deuteronomy 3, we saw Yahweh charging Moses to charge, encourage, and strengthen Joshua because he's going to be the one to lead Israel across. But there's some work to be done here still. So in Deuteronomy 5, we see a repeat of the Ten Commandments. So we're now going back to what was given to them on Sinai 40 years ago. And then in Deuteronomy 6, which we're going to spend some time in here, we really see this, the importance of embedding these teachings and this way of life into the souls of Israel and in the souls of their children. And so in these very first verses, and if you can read 1-3 in Deuteronomy 6, we see this emphatic teaching of Yahweh calling us to this discipline. So if you can read that for us, we'll talk about that a little bit.
Deuteronomy 6, verse 1-3. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the ordinances that Yahweh our God charged me to teach you to observe in the land that you are about to cross into and occupy, so that you and your children and your children's children may fear Yahweh your God all the days of your life and keep all his decrees and his commandments that I am commanding you, so that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe them diligently, so that it may go well with you, and so that you may multiply greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, as Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, has promised you.
So this is one of those passages that is really important to chew on and think about. This is encapsulating a large vision and the importance of this introduction of something important spiritually, which is this. And we see this repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated. God sets out his commands for us to follow and obey so that it may go well with us. And then he gives us a vision of, you know, if you do this, you will enter this land flowing with milk and honey. Now, I do want to park for just a minute and talk about milk and honey. I was thinking a lot about that. I know you and I have been talking about milk and honey. It's an interesting image, right? You know, milk for the people, for Israel, would have most likely been goat milk, but this really representing flourishing herds and flocks. Honey was most likely not honey the way we think about honey. It was actually likely date honey. It was made from boiling dates and water, and it represents kind of flourishing crops and fields. So I found this interesting quote by Rabbi Julie Zupan, who suggests that perhaps because milk is a product of animals and date honey is a product of plants, milk and honey together represent this completeness, this harmony, this fullness. right?
When I think of milk and honey, well, I love that image, first of all. But I'm taken back to my childhood and me and my sister making our glass of milk and pouring honey in it, inspired by this verse. I think, I don't know anyone listening who were preachers' kids. I think along with kind of bathtub baptisms, this is another thing that was part of our childhood. I think even to this day, my sister cannot drink it because it's very, the honey gathers at the bottom and it's, I think it makes her feel a little bit sick now. But that this was us trying to capture our promised land and drink.
I don't think my kids ever did that. Maybe they did and I didn't know, but that's super interesting. So we have this vision of fullness that's being painted, this promised land filled with milk and honey. But it's all within that context of so that it may go well with us. I think sometimes people can really misunderstand the call to obedience. It's like, is he sitting up there with a checklist, you know, making sure that we're obeying and he's blessing us if we do and he's cursing us if we don't? That's not what this is about. This is about our Creator creating for us a way of life and sharing with us this wisdom, right? As our Creator, He gives us these words of life at Sinai and He tells us this is the path, right? So we see right there in verse 3, if hear, O Israel, observe diligently so that it may go well with you, so your life is blessed by this. Right. When we get into the wisdom literature later, you know, we haven't really talked a lot about that, but the wisdom literature is, you know, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job. We see a lot of repetition about this, even from the very beginning in Psalm 1. Happy are those who did not follow the way of the wicked, or take the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers, but they delight in the law of the Lord. They meditate on it day and night. They're like trees planted by streams of water, which yield their fruit in season. And it goes on and on and on. And we see that repetition. So that's going to be a really important concept that's being introduced here. So here we are in the wilderness, about to cross the Jordan, and Yahweh is trying to instill these life-giving spiritual principles in His people. Do what I share with you because you'll be blessed. So that leads us to this important verse that is often called the Shema. Shema is, in Hebrew, it's the word hear. So when we read this scripture, it says, hear, O Israel. It's Shema, O Israel. And I thought it'd be good to read this and talk about this one a little bit. I know that this one, and it's important that it does, but it gets talked about a lot. It gets repeated a lot. Let's talk about Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 9.
Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh alone. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Keep these words that I'm commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children and talk about them when you are at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand, fix them as an emblem on your forehead, and write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates.
So again, context is so important. So we've been in the wilderness for 40 years eating manna. We've seen the presence of God in front of us in this pillar of cloud and fire. Now we're about to go into a totally different place, right? We're going to the promised land. We're going to go to a normal life. And in normal life, guess what happens? We forget about Yahweh.
We forget. Yeah.
Right. You remember when we had Dr. Bernie McGinn, he said, why is it so important to practice the presence of God? It was so deep, right? Because we forget.
Right.
So here we are and we see this concept, these disciplines instilled in the people, a way of repeating these teachings so that they're remembered. And he tells us specifically that we are to bind them. We are to write them on the doorposts of our gates. The Orthodox Jews took this very, very seriously. And we're going to show here a picture of what is called a tefillin or a phylactery. There's two different names for these. They're little boxes that have leather straps. And there was two of them. Inside these boxes were rolled up scrolls where this scripture was written out. And when you would see an Orthodox Jew, even to this day, if you see an Orthodox Jew praying in the morning, in the evening, they will take out their phylacteries or their tefillin, and they will wrap them around their arm. And you can see this interesting pattern. So they'll wrap it around their arm, and the box will sit right next to their heart. Keep this near your heart. And the other one that they'll put on their forehead, which keeps it close to their, you know, their mind. So that's one of the ways that they took this very seriously and repeat these prayers. I was actually traveling last week back from New Jersey, and I got to the airport really early in the morning. And I sat down with my bagel because I was in Newark, New Jersey, and there's great bagels with smoked salmon. It was really good.
Ooh, yum.
But I'm sitting there, I sit down, and as I look up, I see an Orthodox Jew in the corner with his phylactery, and, you know, and he was praying. He had his prayer shawl and he was praying. So this has been taken very seriously for a very long time. The mezuzah is the other thing here that's important. And we'll show a picture here of a mezuzah. So when it says write them on the doorposts of your house, the mezuzah was a little metal box. And similarly, the scroll of the Shema was written and rolled up and put in the mezuzah. And you'll see in a Jewish home, both on the door on the way in and out, but also in other rooms of the house, these mezuzahs that are set at a 45-degree angle. And a lot of times when a Jew will come in and out, a Jewish person comes in or out of their house, they'll touch the mezuzah just to recognize the importance of this. So anyway, I think that's just fascinating to take that really seriously, right?
Yeah. I also love that you've just shown me a new word that rhymes with my last name, mezuzah. Mezuzah. I've only ever thought loser rhymes with my last name, which is really sad.
Oh, that is sad.
So now you've given me another hopeful image.
Okay. That's actually really cool. All right. Yeah. Never thought about that. Mezuzah de Souza. Okay. So, Hannah, how about if you read Deuteronomy 6, 20 to 25 for us?
Yeah. When your children ask you in time to come, what is the meaning of the decrees and the statutes and the ordinances that Yahweh our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your children, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, but Yahweh brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Yahweh displayed before our eyes great and awesome signs and wonders against Egypt, against Pharaoh and all his household. He brought us out from there in order to bring us in, to give us the land that he promised on oath to our ancestors. Then Yahweh commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear Yahweh our God for our lasting good, so as to keep us alive, as is now the case. If we diligently observe this entire commandment before Yahweh our God, as he has commanded us, we will be in the right. Something that's always stood out to me about the Torah and the first five books is this kind of repetition of the passing on of a story and the need for the next generation to hear the stories and those that might not remember the miracles of Yahweh. And I was actually looking at a commentary of Deuteronomy before this, and it was Richard Foster that said that Moses' audience in Deuteronomy is the second generation, the generation of hope, he writes, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, I hadn't thought of that before, about the generation in the wilderness that's kind of died out from their disobedience. And there's this next generation rising up, and there's a lot of hope in that, but then also a need to be reminded of this bigger story that they're a part of. And we see so many verses like the one I just read, and where we see the writer like anticipating the children that will ask them in the future about why they do what they do, why they live the way they live. And there's this clear instruction here to remind them you are part of a bigger story. And I think about what that story is. It's we're a rebellious people, we're a blessed people, and we so serve a holy, fierce, and loving God. Look what he did for us and our forefathers. Look where we started, where we went wrong, but look where we're going. And I think it's fascinating even that we haven't referenced this, but in Exodus 12, while they're even preparing for the very first Passover, and they're being instructed to smear the blood of the lamb on the door frames so the angel of the Lord can pass over. But even then, Moses is already thinking again about what to say to the generations that will ask. Like, when your children ask you, what does this mean? This is what you tell them. And there is this kind of real desire for the next generation to grasp these same stories. There's a quote, and maybe you can read this, Dave, that we love Walter Brueggemann. This is his introduction to the Old Testament. And he kind of reiterates this idea too.
We do love Walter Brueggemann. This Torah is a normative act of imagination that serves to sustain and legitimate a distinct community of gratitude and obedience. That distinct community, whether in the Assyrian, Babylonian, or Persian period, lived among cultural pressures and political powers that had no appreciation of its distinctiveness, no doubt found that distinctiveness at best an inconvenience, and if possible, would have abolished it.
So I think with what's coming, they have the promised land coming, but also I think there's a looking ahead to exile, which will eventually be a reality for the Jewish people too. And there's this need for the Torah to be this, I love that, normative act of imagination that will kind of sustain them, that even when they're in these other lands, these are the stories that are still ours and would hopefully ground them and anchor them, especially when there's this pressure to be a part of the dominant culture around them, which we know we will read about in the future, whether it's in Assyria or Babylon or Persia. But I even think this is the case for us today. And there's so much, I know we can often not see the Old Testament as like our story sometimes as Christians. I think, wow, there's so much we can take from this. And actually what reminded me as I was preparing for this today was a story from when I lived in Moldova in a couple years ago now. And I was out there helping to work for a church along with a group of others from the family of churches that we're a part of. And Moldova is a neighboring country to Ukraine. We were situated very close to the border. So when the war started, that was a really scary time and everything kind of changed for us living there. We kind of have this time frame of before the war and after the war. And I have very strong memories of standing in the lobby of the conference center where a lot of us were living, just welcoming van loads of Ukrainians with men, women, children, babies that had suddenly become refugees overnight. And we all lived together in this conference center. And maybe some of you listening helped donate money. We got lots of donations. And so thank you if that was you, because that's the reason why we could house so many in that building with us, was from donations. But naturally, when they left Ukraine, they're in a hurry and just grabbed whatever they could. But I have this memory of one day sitting with one of the mums, and she'd been wearing the same outfit for a few days in a row. And I don't know if she was self-conscious or not, but she kind of said to me, I don't normally look like this in my country. And it caught me off guard. And she said, let me show you. And we sat down on the sofa and she gets her phone out and shows me her Instagram page. And she pulls it up and I see, oh, she has a lot of followers. Not that that's important, but she showed me her following count. And then the photos of just her family, her husband, her sons. There was a certain point where men over the age of 18 couldn't cross, leave Ukraine. So I hadn't met her sons. She shows me them and their home. And then she says to me, this is me. This is where I'm from. And as I was thinking about the role of the Torah and kind of, yeah, this moment in Moldova with this sister, this mom came to mind. And I think, of course, there was no technology back then. But if there was, I can imagine some of these elders of the families of Israel, in, whether it's in the promised land or in exile, especially I think in exile later on, but showing kind of like this family album of memories, whether that's Eden, the fall, the rainbow, the Exodus, the Red Sea, the tabernacle, the pillar of fire and pillar of cloud and manna, and saying to their children, this is who we are, like not what you see around you, but this is where we're from and this is our God. And I think of that because obviously now we're in 2024 and we all have our own stories and places that we're from, but we as people of faith, we're also a part of this story, and this is our origin story too, and one we're called to meditate on, as the scripture said. And I think this ability to hold the two stories in tension, we love the word tension, and to hold those two identities in tension, I imagine it's what Jesus might have meant when he says later in the New Testament to his followers that they're called to be in the world, but not of this world. And that's kind of what I see here with this story being told to the next generation. Just remember that this is your story too.
It's such an interesting point. And the whole reason we chose this direction with the podcast, the story, God's call to remember the story. This is our story. I like how you just said that. This is our story. these are our ancestors. This is part of the great cloud of witnesses. And that's really what happens in the rest of the book of Deuteronomy. It's a reminder. We're told, I mean, you go through these chapters, remember the reason you were chosen in chapter 8. It's not because you were more numerous. It's not because you're super righteous, right? I chose you because I chose you and I loved you. Then he goes on, remember the golden calf incident. That wasn't good. Remember that Yahweh saved us from Pharaoh and from slavery. That was good. Remember the commands, as we're talking here about obedience. Write them down. Bind them to your soul. Don't follow other gods. So it is this constant, remember the story, remember the story, remember the story. There's one more passage I want to look at here in Deuteronomy 12 that talks about the importance of remembering. And it says in verse 10 and 11, when you cross over the Jordan and live in that land that Yahweh your God is allotting you, and when he gives you rest from your enemies all around and you live in safety, then you shall bring everything that I command you to the place that Yahweh your God will choose as a dwelling for his name. Your offerings and sacrifices and tithes and donations and all your gifts that you vow to Yahweh. So again, once you get into normal life, once you're not forced to see the presence of God in the tabernacle around you, once you have your fill of milk and honey, remember to bring your gifts into the presence of God. Make the choice to come into the presence of God. Remember how important that is. So this really is, I mean, why it's called the second giving of the law. It's not that they didn't hear a lot of these things before, but Israel needed to be reminded. One of the most important disciplines for Christians today is to read the story, right? Read the Bible, read your story, because it reminds us, it reminds us, it reminds us, it reminds us, because we so quickly forget. So the last couple things that happen just in a bullet point way, you know, we see in Deuteronomy as these chapters unfold that we're supposed to take hard stances against anyone who entices us to follow another god. We are, now this is an interesting one that would be really fun to bring back. Every 7 years, reset the debt clock, right? I mean, if you owe anyone that. Anything.
All my student loans.
Right. It's gone. Hit reset on all the debt. That would be great. Another important one that we're reminded is being willing to take care of those among us that are in need. That was an integral part of the spirituality of Israel. Deuteronomy 16, remember the festivals that I told you to follow. Deuteronomy 28, remember to obey and you'll be blessed. And then we see toward the end, this transition in Deuteronomy 31, Joshua succeeds Moses. And then we kind of see the end of the book of Deuteronomy with the song of Moses, another song that gets recorded, which is really powerful. So as we kind of bring this in for a closing, and you're right, Hannah, we have not crossed into the promised land, even though we called the episode Promised Land. It is about preparing, but it's all about our, you know, what's it going to take to come into promised land? And right. How we're going to live there and the leadership that's needed there. But as we conclude this, I want to, if you could read Deuteronomy 30 as we bring this in for conclusion. I think this is a really great passage to end with.
Surely this commandment that I'm commanding you today is not too hard for you, nor is it too far away. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will go up to heaven for us and get it for us that we may hear and observe it? Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross to the other side of the sea for us and get it for us that we may hear it and observe it? No, the word is very near to you. It is in your mouth and in your heart for you to observe. See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity.
Yeah, it's such a great way to kind of close this out. It's basically like it's Yahweh saying, hey, guys, you can do this. This isn't that hard. I mean, don't make excuses. It's not beyond you. Live this way. You'll be blessed. It's kind of a cool way to end this. So we're about to cross into the promised land, Hannah. In the next episode, we'll actually cross into the promised land.
And we'll have a special guest with us next week, Dr. Michael Burns.
Yes, Dr. Michael Burns. For those of us that grew up on The Simpsons, I always liked Dr. Burns. Mr. Burns. I know, but I was just, when I'd call Michael, I'd call Mr. Burns. I'm sure he gets that from a lot of people. Now it's Dr. Burns. So yeah, it'll be great to have that conversation. We're going to jump into Joshua, the actual crossing over, and we're going to deal with some of the difficult things that we see happen as they come into the promised land. So Hannah, always great to see you. Hey, next week, I want to check up on Gilgamesh, by the way.
Okay. How's Gilgamesh? I'll be ready. Oh, okay. What now?
Well,
save it next week.
We'll save it for next week. All right. Okay. Good to see you. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for joining this Thread conversation.
We're more than a podcast. Check out threadpodcast.org for more immersive content.
Though I'm waiting on you, I get a better view of this boundless world that I'm